Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. And it's great to have Melinda Myers as our guest today. She's a nationally known gardening expert, a TV and radio host, author, columnist. She's written over 20 gardening books, including the very popular second edition of Midwest Gardener's Handbook, All You Need to Know to Plant, Maintain a Midwest Garden. And we'll talk with her about getting food from your landscape. So as we visit about that, I hope you'll join in with your gardening questions. You can give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Melinda Myers, welcome back.
Hey, always a pleasure, Larry.
So let's talk about adding edibles to your landscape. And I imagine there are pros and maybe some cons to that.
You know, when I was a small space gardener in the city of Milwaukee for many years, you know, I, as a horticulturist and gardener, like all of your listeners, there's never enough room. And so I'd always mix my herbs in with my perennials. I love the texture and the fragrance. In fact, one of my neighbors said, "You must be a good cook," which I'm not really known for that skill. And I said, "No, I just like the way they look," though I do now. I've improved my cooking skills. But I find doing things like asparagus as a backdrop in your flower bed, you know, you harvest it, and when you're done harvesting that, those ferny green, you know, the greenery looks great as a backdrop to your perennial. So it's some place that maybe you would just put a big perennial, so make the use. You can harvest early and do that. How about rhubarb as a temporary shrub? You know, have it, enjoy it, those big leaves, harvest early. Enjoy the big foliage, the bulb foliage, and then when winter comes, it's, you know, going to die back. You can pile your non-de-icing salted snow right in that spot. And then there's so many compact and ornamental vegetables and even fruit on the market now. The Bushel and Berry collection of compact fruit, raspberry shortcake, one of my favorites, thornless, 2 to 3 feet tall, and it doesn't spread as aggressively as other raspberries. Grow it in a pot, put it in a small space. They have baby cakes, blackberry, and blueberries, too, and even some for hanging baskets now. The Midnight Cascade and Sapphire Cascade, a little hard to find, so you may have to order them or ask your favorite garden center and encourage them to carry them in the future.
So it sounds like you can put these right amongst the flowers or maybe as a border.
You bet. So one of the things, so if you're growing, say, a big tomato, get a pretty obelisk, you know, something to support it. So it's a feature, train your tomato up. And when it's fruiting, you've got the yellow or the red or even purple fruit of the tomato to add to it. Peppers are an easy one, right? They're 2 to 3 feet tall. Some are even a little more compact. Full sun, moist, well-drained soils, just like most your flowers like. And then when they're fruiting, they're just like your flowers, only it's edible instead. Even watermelons and squash, you can train up on a support. I've used pole beans and cucumbers on a nice-looking trellis as a screen. One master gardener, when I was working with Extension, part of his fence fell down, and instead of repairing it right away, he put up a trellis and grew his pole beans. I think he had to repair his fence. His spouse kind of didn't like that idea, but he got 1 year of growing beans as an option. And so it's really looking at how you could substitute those edible plants for something you'd normally grow that would be pretty. So, you know, a vine that has edible fruit on it, you know, pole beans, squash, watermelons. You do need to sling those big fruits, otherwise they'll rot the vine or pull it down as well. And so you want to make sure you sling it. And macrame is back for those of us that lived through the first round. And Chicago Botanic Garden had some great examples where they had macrame slings tied to their decorative obelisks. So it was a conversation piece and much prettier than an old T-shirt holding up your watermelon on an obelisk.
I would say so. You know, I went to your website, and I must say I went to your webinar on this.
Oh, thanks.
It is It is so great. You've got that webinar. Well, all of your webinars are, but this one, I love how you mix really great photos and pictures of what you're talking about. It's really a lot of fun to watch.
Well, thank you. And we were recently at, I was recently at Chicago Botanic Garden, which is great for those of us coming from Wisconsin. It's north of Chicago, so you don't have to go through Chicago. But they had great examples. They had this beautiful vertical garden with colorful lettuce. It was just amazing, and pansies. You know, we kept going back. I was there with one of my team members, and we just kept going back because it was so eye-catching. then they had another garden with kale and lettuce and stalks and pansies. Again, we turned the corner, and it was just gorgeous. And so, you know, there's so much you can do with some of these colorful decorative greens as well. Swiss chard, bright light Swiss chard. Peppermint Swiss chard. We've mixed them in with our perennials at Wisconsin State Fair at Energy Park. The kales, texture, the blue-green color, just wonderful additions to containers. So if you don't have a lot of room, use those as a vertical accent in your pots as well. And you mentioned my webinar. It's up, and the handout will be up the remainder of this year for sure, so that people can watch the recording at their convenience.
And there's many more. We'll talk some more about the webinars that you've got and some of your appearances coming up as well. I want to take a couple of calls, though. Sue in Des Moines, Iowa, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I'm on the road from Fond du Lac to Des Moines today. I always listen to you when I'm on the road. I love it.
Well, what's on your mind today?
Well, I want to know about rhubarb. I've had it for a few years, but it's so spindly, I don't have enough to grow up to make a pie. How can I transplant it to the best part of the yard, and how do I amend the soil to get success?
Well, my guess is, so compost is the magical thing, whether you have sandy soil that drains quickly or heavy clay that drains poorly. So compost works great. And Cornell University found that compost-amended soil grew healthier plants that were more pest and disease resistant. Rhubarb likes full sun. Typically, we like to divide it, dig and divide it, just as it's, I like to do it in the spring, just as it's starting to emerge. It's pretty big right now, so I, you know, if you really had to, you might get away with it, but it's really going to stress that already stressed plant. The second time is a lot of gardeners will dig and divide it in the fall as it's starting to go dormant. I just like to do it in the spring because I can see if it's made it through the winter, then I can find it just as it's starting to emerge. Full sun, moist, well-drained soils, they usually don't need a lot of fertilizer. But if you've got that soil draining well, especially during the winter, that's key. And I think making sure it gets plenty of sun. So if you can let it get through this year, and then after transplanting, I'd give it a year to get reestablished before starting to harvest. If you know any gardeners, I'm sure they're happy to share their harvest, right?
I was going to say, why not sneak over to the neighbors in the meantime?
They may leave a bag for you so you can take plenty.
Sue, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to John in Janesville. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Say, I've got a couple of kinds of asparagus, and I don't know the name, the purple and then there's green, but the purple seems to, it yields well, but on one hill of it, I am getting it starting to curve as it comes up, and there's something eating on the shoot as it comes up, and then it deforms it. What is? I know there's an insect that's there. I can't see it, but how do I treat that?
Great question. And I have the same issue, John. And every fall, I'm like, clean up the asparagus bed. It's asparagus beetle that feeds on it. And you're right. You described it perfectly. The shoots come up and they're very deformed. They usually are very active in the hotter afternoon hours. So sometimes going out there, you might be able to find them. That way, if you choose to treat, you could use an organic, something that's a contact, like insecticidal soap or horticulture oil. I usually find I have enough. And then the other thing, the preventative, is in the fall, instead of allowing the greens to stand after they've turned yellow, leave them stand for winter, which is what I always do, catches the snow, increases hardiness. But that's also where they overwinter. So doing remove that top growth after it turns yellow and get it out of the garden. And that's one of the easiest and very effective ways to manage this insect. So go out in the hot part of the afternoon, see if you can find the beetles. You could do some hand picking, knocking them into soapy water, or try some of the organic controls labeled for asparagus and asparagus beetles. And that's usually a very sufficient way to take care of it. And I feel your frustration. Mark your calendar. Maybe we should remind each other, John, to clean up the bed in the fall.
There you go, John. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or we could email you to ideas@WPR.org. Get you on pretty quickly. Nicole in Waterford, we'll move to you now. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Nicole.
Oh, we lose Nicole? Oh, she had some flower beds with weeds, but maybe she'll call back. Is she there? Nicole, are you there? Huh. Because I guess she has left us.
Okay.
But that's all right. We got plenty of other things we can talk about. One of the things in your webinar that I noticed, and I've never grown them myself, are artichokes.
Yes. This is one of those bragging rights things. If you really want a big harvest, we're in the wrong state. But Imperial Star has beautiful silvery leaves. I usually buy my transplants. You can start them inside. You need to get a jump start just like you would your tomatoes and peppers. But I usually buy the transplants, and I'm finding more and more garden centers are carrying it. And then I'll tell you, they're beautiful plants. They form the choke, probably 3 or 4 per plant. They're 2 to 3 inches in diameter. If you let them go, they have a thistle-like flower that the pollinators love. But I'll tell you, it's one of those kind of things you grow because you want to say, I grew artichokes in Wisconsin. But it is fun to harvest them, steam them. I've had pretty good success. I find the ground squirrels and the rabbits do like them, so you're going to need to watch for those critters. They like to eat the plants. But a fun one to grow, and it's pretty. You could grow it in a pot. So that way, if we end up with a cool summer and they don't reach maturity as soon as you'd like, you could bring that pot inside when danger of frost occurs, back out during that warm spell we always get after the first hard frost, and extend the season that way. And so in a container, if you're feeling like, I don't want to invest in a few, just try one, put them in a pot, and they look pretty on your patio deck or balcony, your front steps, and full sun, moist well-drained soil, very pretty plants, too. So even if you don't get the chokes, they look nice, but it's fun to harvest them.
Fun to harvest them. Melinda Meyer is our guest, nationally known gardening expert. Great to have her with us for Garden Talk. Jill Nadeau, by the way, is our producer. Jeff Robbins, our technical director. I'm Larry Mailer for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR. Larry Mailer here with my guest, Melinda Myers. She has a great website, by the way, melindamyers.com. Take a look at it because there's lots of really good information on it. And Nicole in Waterford, I think, is back with us. So
great.
Let's go to Nicole. Hi, Nicole.
Hi there. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So I have a couple of flower beds that are full of gout weed, and I'm wondering what to do.
Yeah, so gout weed planted once as a ground cover, and it is an invasive plant, so it shouldn't be sold anymore, but it was a very popular ground cover, and as you found, it can just take over a garden bed. So a couple of things you may want to do. If your garden bed has more gout weed than it has your desirable plants, I would dig up the ones you want to keep, but pot them up first, because you want to make sure if you've taken any piece of the roots or rhizomes of the gout weed, you don't replant it once you get it under control in the bed. Then you can edge that garden bed, and then you can cover it either with clear plastic to heat it up and cook the top, 6 inches or so, or black plastic to smother it and leave it on all season. With the clear plastic, at least 6 to 8 weeks during the hottest part of the season. So basically, you're sacrificing that garden bed. Maybe something you don't want to do. You can use a total vegetation killer. And what I like to do, I try not to use it often, but sometimes you just, it's your best bet for the weed you're battling or the invasive plant, is I'll take a milk jug, cut the bottom out, and if I have more weeds than flowers, I cover my flowers. If I have more flowers than weeds, I'll put that milk jug over that weed, and then I can spray in, hit the weed, and then let it drip dry, then move the jug to the next one and the next one. And that way you protect your good plants, because if the treated leaves hit the good plants, it can cause damage. Or if you accidentally spray and hit the good plants, you can cause damage. So there's also another total vegetation killer called Finale that has a little different mode of action. So if you're kind of hesitant to use Roundup, you might want to check out Finale, F-A-N-A-L-E. And those are total vegetation killers that kill the top and the roots. But you're going to need to do several applications as well. So I'm sorry to hear you've got, I know that's a tough one to get rid of.
Yeah.
And so it's persistence. You need to be more persistent than the weeds. So good luck with that, and it'll be worth it once you get it under control.
Yeah, thank you, Nicole, for calling. Good luck. Terry in Lake Geneva will go to you now. Hi, Terry.
Hi, how are you all doing?
Great, appreciate the call.
Well, actually, as I'm sitting here listening to your show, I came up with like 5 other questions. I'll ask the most important one, and I'm not sure if you are knowledgeable about this, but I was wondering if you know anything on how to get rid of Creeping Charlie once it gets in your yard.
So is it in your lawn, or is it in the flower bed?
It's in the lawn, but now it's starting to edge, along the borders of my flower beds.
Okay, so we'll do it kind of separately. So Creeping Charlie, when it's in the lawn, the University of Wisconsin found all the stuff that you tried that didn't work, if you apply it when it's in full bloom, and I'm guessing, I have some Creeping Charlie along my garage, it was just starting to flower, so treating it with all those things you tried, like the 2,4-D, that type of thing, Weed Be Gone, that will take care of it. Now, keeping in mind that it'll kill the existing plant, but there's all the weed seed in the ground. The second time you can apply it is after a hard frost in the fall. So it will take a few years to get it under control. There is a product that is promoted as great for killing Creeping Charlie, and it contains dicamba or Banvel. And it's hard on our trees and shrubs, so I really don't like to recommend that just because Creeping Charlie often gets its foothold in the shade under our trees and shrubs. So timing is real critical. So that's in the lawn. You don't want to use those products. You don't want to use a broadleaf weed killer in your garden bed, right? If you're looking for something organic, you can try the iron chelated iron products that contain Feheta, F-E-H-E-D-T-A, or HEDTA, H-E-D-T-A. Now, these are chelated irons that are at a much higher concentration than the ones we use for fertilizing. So it would be, I think EcoSense is one of the products. Whitney Farms, I think, was bought by Scotts, and they had a product too. So look for those that are chelated iron as their active ingredient to kill the weeds. The weeds turn black. If it gets on your grass, they just turn dark green. For your garden bed, this is one you may want to edge the garden to slow the infiltration of grass and the Creeping Charlie. This is where digging may be effective if it's just starting to take over. As you know, any little piece can infect, can start a new plant. So you want to be sure you weed and dispose of properly. And that's another one where you could use like a total vegetation killer. The organic grass and weed killers just burn the tops of the plant, which, you know, you could do the same thing by cutting it to ground level and continually keeping after it. But if you opt for one of the organic, it's just going to burn the tops and you'll need to do repeated applications. So those are a couple things to help you in the lawn and then doing something different in your flower bed.
Yeah, there you go, Terry. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Jim in Cambridge, we go to you now. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, good morning. And Melinda, great to hear your voice again. I first heard you a long time ago when you were on the air in Milwaukee.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to hang out with you and Larry and all his listeners. And I missed my time on my Saturday morning show. So this is so thank you, Jim, for calling in. This is great.
Well, before I retired, I hung out with Larry as an extension producer of video conferences.
A while back, Jim.
You bet. You bet. Nice to hear you're still rolling along, Larry. Thank you. What I'm going to be doing, Melinda, is growing some peppers in a pot. So what can I add in terms of fertilizer or natural things when I plant them?
So I have to tell you a funny story about peppers in a pot. When I lived in the city, my ex-husband was also a horticulturist, and our neighbor would put like 20 peppers in this big pot outside her door, and we'd, you know, two plant people, and oh, that's way too many plants. You know, she had this huge harvest, which really irritated it. We had our peppers properly spaced, you know, one in a pot, and she had this huge harvest. So sometimes it doesn't matter what you do. So, Jim, what I would recommend, I use Milorganite. It's not organic, so it's a biosolid. And I like it because I apply it when I plant and if needed once mid-season. Any of the, if you prefer an organic, I think Bonide has some organic products. I find I use, and I don't work with them, but I love the product, Sue, HSU, Organic Potting Mix. It's hard to find, but they use rice hulls for drainage. They include leaf compost. So for me, it holds the moisture a little longer. And I find because it's got compost, leaf compost, just a little bit of peat, it seems to be very nutritious. And I've had great success growing vegetables and flowers in that potting mix. But find the mix that works best for you. If you fertilize at the time of planting, then mid-season, if it's a hot summer and you're watering a lot, which is typical, you may need to give it another boost of fertilizer. So check the label of the product that you use. And peppers like Full Sun, moist, well-drained soil. Now, I like to mix my containers. I like to put herbs and flowers and vegetables together. Now, my peppers or my tomatoes won't produce as much because they've got all these other plants in the pot. So if you want the most peppers, you put one pepper for every 2 to 3 gallon pot that you grow. But that's just a matter of, you know, how many peppers you want to harvest, how many pots you have, and do you want to add some flowers and herbs to make it look pretty and a little more edibles to harvest. So a good quality mix with drainage holes in your pot. And the bigger the pot, the less often you water. Add your fertilizer at time of planting. I like wool pellets, which is a sustainable product that helps retain moisture, increases airspace, and it has 9% nitrogen slow release. So you get a little bit of nutrients. You have to water less often and good environment for your plants. And so that might be something else you want, especially if you don't have time to check your containers and water them every day, as most of us we need to with the summer weather that we have.
You know, hot peppers, there's many of them are attractive in a pot, just in and of themselves.
You know, that's so true. And I find the hot peppers tend to perform very well for us, too. They seem to be very prolific. Yes, and there's one called Cayenetta out of an All America selection that has narrow red fruit, great for a container, and they kind of hang down on the outside of the plant for easy picking. And there's a jalapeno pepper called pot apeño, and it's made for a hanging basket or a container. And I grow it every year, and then in the fall, I can bring it in, put it in a sunny window, and I can keep harvesting peppers and, you know, until November, into December.
Wow.
So kind of a fun thing. And like you said, they're very pretty. You know, as the fruit, you can watch it grow and develop and color up.
Yep, absolutely. Jim, good luck, and thanks for calling. Good to hear your voice. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@WPR.org or talk@WPR.org. Teresa in Watertown, we go to you now. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I don't know if you can help me with this, but I have raised garden beds, and
okay.
I have ants in them. Yeah, yeah.
I'm laughing because I have one bed and they're always on the edge. And my bed, I usually, you know, after I've been kneeling and weeding, I usually go over to my raised bed so I can sit on the edge and give my knees a break. And these ants are always, I forget, right? You'd think I'd remember, crawling up my arm. And they're not supposed to bite, but I swear these bite. So a couple things. And I feel like I'm treading on P.J. Leash, the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab director, his territory. There are some things that, you know, I try to live with them until they really cause damage. You know, all the practices of hot water and things just moves them to a new spot. If you want to use something, make sure it's labeled for use in around food crops. And typically, and Larry, jump in because I know you spend more time with PJ Leash on your show.
Yeah.
You need to get that product down in the ground to get to the base. There are some other products that are a little bit borax-based products, but you have to be careful around your plants because boron's used in small amounts and it could damage your plants. So I just think anything that gets them to move along out of the way, but raised beds are perfect, right? Great drainage. The soil tends to be better than what's in the ground, nice and warm because they're elevated. And so I try not to use any products, but, you know, you might want to use something labeled for ant control around food plants. And, Larry, I don't know if you have any thoughts from your time that you and PJ have spent together, or Bill?
Basically, just taking a rod or something and poking it down to make a pathway down as deep as you can to get to the queen. That sort of takes care of the ant population if you get to the queen. So that's the only other thing that I think I would add to it. And by the way, Jill just let me know that PJ is back on June 19th. So we can bring that up with him on June 19th. But certainly what you said is correct, at least as far as I know and whatever PJ told me.
Okay.
I was outside the other day along the edge of the property, and I had a plastic thing of just a container, and I went to pick it up, and I was holding it, and I suddenly looked at my arm, and I must have had 40 ants on my arm. They just they were all over the place, and I'm with you. I thought I got a couple of bites out of it.
Yes, exactly. I went online, and everybody said, oh, they don't bite. I'm like, well, mine do. So I hear you. So, Teresa, I feel your pain literally. And, yeah, as Larry mentioned, if you do to use a pesticide, make sure that it gets down to that queen. Otherwise, it's hard to take care of it. You'll be treated more often.
Yep. There you go, Teresa. Thank you for calling. Tom in Merton will move to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Melinda. I have two questions. I think egregious mistakes I made. One of them is last fall I put leaves from my yard in the part of my garden where I plant corn.
Okay.
And then tilled them in the spring. And after that, I found out that that's going to steal nitrogen as the leaves decompose away from the corn. Can I throw on a heavy organic nitrogen fertilizer?
Yeah, and you may want to wait and see. Typically, I like to till my leaves in the fall because then they break down over winter. leaving them as a mulch on the soil. And hey, Tom, we all learn, I think, more from our mistakes we make.
Yes.
And so, and a low nitrogen, an organic nitrogen would be a good option because that'll feed the microorganisms that are breaking down the leaves. And I find they're not as bad as wood chips or wood products in terms of tying up the nitrogen. But corn is a heavy feeder. Mm-hmm. So I think your idea of adding an organic or a low nitrogen slow release, you can always add more. You can't take it away, and monitor the plant growth. So I would start with the recommended rate, monitor how your plants are growing, and you can always side dress as needed if it looks like they, you know, the leaves are paler than they should be or the plants aren't growing as fast. You know, you can always add some more, but you can't take it away. But organics are good because they're slow release. You won't risk, you know, pushing a lot of top growth at the expense of roots. And I think your ideas will work well, Tom.
I agree. Tom, good luck. Thank you for calling. Diane in Beaver Dam, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Diane.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about a cleaver, a weed that's growing on the side of the hill by my house. It's 12 to 18 inches long, and it's a sticky weed. Latin name is Gallium anthurine. And I'm wondering, how can I get a hold of it? It's just spreading like crazy.
Gallium is in that family of bed straw. And if it's the one that's sticky, I think I have it too, called Sticky Willy. And it pulls really easy, I know, but then it recedes and then it's an issue. And so you may want to so is it growing amongst flowers? What's it growing with?
Yeah, it's actually have a really nice hill with a fox on, like native fox and Virginia bluebells, and it's just taking over that and crushing them. And you know, I've had pulled it for years, but I can't get a grip on it. You know.
Yeah. So the problem is anything, you know, if you're going to use any product on it, you're going to need to spot treat. And I don't know if you heard me talk about using the milk jug treatment. Pulling is your first option. And trust me, the weeds are doing great in my garden right now. You know, anytime any of us have time to go out, it rains, it seems like.
Yeah.
So, you know, the weeds are growing fast and furious. And because you've got a lot of desirable plants in there, you know, if you can pull and mulch in between, just as the plants grow, they'll help crowd things out. Spot treating is an option, but you, again, want to be careful. Even if you can just cut them back at ground level, at least so they don't recede, that's another way. And then just kind of keeping after it. If it's easier for you to, you know, reach down, cut it at ground level, and then just keep after it that way. I'm just worried about, you know, you've got lots of other good plants in there that you're going to end up damaging them if you're using any kind of weed killer. But, again, protecting the good ones from any spray if you do opt. And make sure it's one labeled for flower beds. You don't want to use broadleaf weed killers because they last in the soil and they're taken up by the roots of the plants and will damage your flowers as well. I wish I had an easy solution, Diane. My yard would look a lot better, too, if I did.
Diane, good luck, and thank you so much for calling. Listener emailed to ask if you had advice on the best method for killing or removing large areas of ditch lilies. So I'm assuming those orange lilies that we see along the roadsides,
right.
And many of us and many folks have in their gardens.
You bet. So that's the day lily that has got out of control. And one of the problems is it is considered invasive. And so there's, again, nothing easy. So if you did a total vegetation killer with it, sometimes running over the leaves of things that have glossy leaves kind of seems to open them up, and so it takes up like the Roundup or Finale better. And I've had landscape contractors tell me hard to control weeds, they've had a little bit better luck with Finale, but keep in mind that kills anything it touches. You know, starvation, cutting it back, mowing. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has a great website, a little hard to find. So what I do if I'm looking for something, and I think daylilies is on their list of invasive plants, you go Wisconsin DNR, and then you type in the invasive plant. So it'd be orange daylily, and it would take you to the page, or you'd do, you know, garlic mustard or whatever. And then they talk about how to identify it, but also different control, mechanical, chemical, those kind of things. So they give you several options. And what I like is, you know, sometimes the chemical stuff takes several applications. You want to make sure you use the right concentration, but there may be another option. So there's really, with the daylilies, it's kind of like any of those weed plants, you know, cutting it back to ground level, continuing, so you starve that root system. Spot treating with a total vegetation killer, you'll probably need several applications and protect the good plants nearby. And yeah, it's a tough one because it's in the ditches and along the roadway, and it continues to spread. One of the other things that minimally do is if you can cut it back before it sets seed, at least you won't have more seedlings forming and reduce the spread that way. I know it'll continue to get to be a bigger clump, but at least you prevent it from reseeding. So that's another thing to keep in mind as you're trying to control any kind of weed or invasive plant. If you can do nothing but prevent it from reseeding, that's at least the first step.
Vivian in Deerfield, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Vivian.
Hi, good morning. You know, you were talking about gout weed, and I think it's bishop weed. I think it is.
Yeah, same thing, right.
And we have been battling that in our front yard, a large area of about 22 by 30 feet. There's it's a beautiful maple tree in the middle of it. We took out, I must have had like 35, 40 hostas, beautiful hostas and other perennials. We took them all out and tried to save as many as we could, and we are watching them to make sure that they don't bring, you know, the weed with them,
right,
which is working out. But we did put a tarp over it and had it there at the beginning of the year until about, I'd say 3 or 4 weeks ago. Well, of course, it's coming in like gangbusters.
And I think we may have lost Vivian.
Yeah.
She brings up a good point. To really be effective, you have to do it throughout the growing season. And I know none of us, you know, our growing season is so short. None of us want to sacrifice. But the problem is, as she found out, you know, the roots are going to survive. And then you remove it, and they have enough stored energy. It's one of the reasons they're so aggressive and they're adaptable, and that's why they're invasive, is then they have enough stored energy to send out new growth. And, boy, with all the rain we've had and the, you know, perfect growing conditions. So, Vivian, if you can hear me, I would throw, you know, you may want to mow that down as short as you can, edge the bed again so that, you know, it's not going to spread out. And nothing, if there's any on the outside of that edged area, they're not going to support what's underneath the tarp. And then I would leave that tarp on all summer long. I'm just worried that, you know, you could use a black landscape fabric instead so that you're getting air and moisture down for the tree, because you don't want to kill the tree in the efforts to kill that crown, that gout weed or bishop's weed, both goes by both names. So, you know, you could do that. I know some people will take old carpet and throw it down and use that to smother as well. And so I like things that let the air through so that you're not damaging the tree roots. But you might want to try that throughout the growing season. And, it's a battle. So good luck, Vivian.
Yeah, thanks, Vivian, for calling. Appreciate it. Melinda Myers, our nationally known gardening expert, our guest today. Her website, melindamyers.com. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. I just want to add to what Sarah and Rob mentioned. Our show, beginning on Monday and including Garden Talk all the way through to Friday, will be 2 hours long. And just to remind you, you may need to listen to it on another of our stations or you may listen to it or may need to listen to it in another way. So, you know, just be sure to go and check out WPR.org/new if you're worried or wondering about the changes, and especially to this program. We're getting an extra half hour, so that's kind of cool. Melinda, you have, we talked a little bit, I should say, about your webinars, and I know you've got the ornamental fruits and vegetables one that I watch is great, but and that, by the way, is going to be in our show notes. It'll be available after 1:30 today, or you can go to melindamyers.com and look at it that way. What's the next topic, and how do we watch again?
You know, my website, melindamyers.com, and on the right-hand side of the homepage are all the upcoming appearances and webinars that I will be having. And then there's an icon at the bottom, Watch On Demand, so you can see past recordings and get the handout. So on June 5th, I'll be doing Underappreciated Pollinators, part of our library program. We Energies is sponsoring the library program. This is our fourth year, and we've teamed up with the Public Libraries of Wisconsin and the UP of Michigan. But everybody's welcome to tune in. On the website, we not only have links to the recordings and registration to sign up for that June 5th Underappreciated Pollinators, but also some activities and videos to help you. You know, we did, let's see, we had container gardening throughout the year. That recording is up there, and some tips on repurposing items into containers. And, you know, in June, it's grow a sunflower in a pot or your garden. And so what's exciting is the libraries are so important to our communities and such a great way to reach people. And so it's been great to team up with them in many libraries. So if you're in Wisconsin or the UP of Michigan, check with your local library. Some are doing extra activities. Some are having viewing parties. So, you know, they, you can gather at your library and watch the webinar live and post your questions. And it's just a great way for us to team up with educators across the state and the UP. But again, everybody's welcome to join in. In-person-wise, on Saturday the 18th, tomorrow, from 11 to 1, I'm doing Ask the Plant Doctor at Ebert's Greenhouse Village. So if you're in the area of Exonia, which is west of Oconomowoc, I'll be on hand. I'm just hanging out by the checkout line because everybody wants to buy their plants and go home and plant. And so my job tomorrow is, on Saturday, is to just answer questions. So, you know, you have a question, what's wrong? So if you're looking for me, I'm there. And on June 1st, I'll be back at Ebert's, and I'll be hosting a presentation on hydrangea selection, planting, pruning, of course, everyone's big question, and care. And that's on June 1st as well.
Lots going on there, for sure. Well, Lottie in Silver Lake has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Lottie.
Hey, how's it going? You just mentioned hydrangeas. I don't know if I can sneak in another quick question. On the hydrangeas, I see them in white and pink and bluish-purple colors. Do the colors eventually turn white as they mature, or do they stay the same purple or pink color throughout their season?
Good question. So there's several different types of hydrangeas. So the old-fashioned Annabelle hydrangea with the big, round, white flowers, typically, there's a new group called the Invincible Spirit, which have pink flowers, and they're pink no matter your soil pH. Now, those are the easiest to grow. Hardy in zone 3, they flower on new growth, so the white flowers typically start out green, turn white, and fade back to green. In fact, there's some new varieties introduced. You know, I think they're embracing that green, where the ones that didn't turn white, and so they're green all season. Now, the big leaf hydrangeas are the ones that are blue in acid soil, pink in alkaline soil. And they're the ones I think so many of us saw in Tennessee and Georgia, big and beautiful. The problem is the older varieties introduced were only hardy to above ground to like zone 6. So they typically would die back to the ground here in Wisconsin and a lot of the Midwest and North, send up new growth, but you get leaves and no flowers. So then in endless summer and some of the new ones that were introduced flower on old and new growth. But a lot of people have been disappointed in some of those repeat bloomers. So if they die back to the ground, You didn't get that first flush, but you got, hopefully, a second flush of bloom. A lot of the breeders are working on introducing repeat bloomers that are a little more vigorous, like Pop Star is a new one out of Bailey Nursery. And the idea here is, yes, it will die back to the ground the most winters for us, but it'll send up new growth, and it's vigorous enough that it starts flowering much earlier than some of those other repeat blooming hydrangeas. Those are pink and alkaline soil, and then they go from pink, usually go from pink to brown or blue in acidic soil, and they go from blue to brown. There are some kind of white, there are some white flowered big leaf hydrangeas too that may have a little blush of pink or blue depending. The other thing I wanted to mention, because a lot of people will buy one and it's blue and they plant it in southern Wisconsin where our pH is high or very alkaline, and then it'll still be blue maybe the first year. Then the next year you'll get some pink and some blue because the roots are starting to leave that potting mix that was very acidic that the plant was grown in exploring the more high pH alkaline soil around it, pulling that up. So it's an aluminum is what causes the blue, and it's tied up in alkaline soil. So you may get then that pink and blue, and then eventually it turns to pink and alkaline soil. Very hard to get it to be blue unless you do have acidic soil. So a long answer to your hydrangea question. Sorry about that.
Thank you very much for calling. Cheryl in Berlin, we'll go to you. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I have a bumper crop of dandelions. Unbelievable. What is the easiest way to get rid of those things?
I'm going to do my healthy lawns are the best defense against weeds. Mowing high, that will help your lawn form deeper roots and crowd out those weeds, including dandelions. I'm lucky I live in the country, so my neighbors don't care because I too have a bumper crop of dandelions. And so keeping your lawn healthy, there's been some research that shows even one fertilization a year on your lawn can help reduce weeds by up to 50%. So if you're not fertilizing your lawn, I would recommend starting. Memorial Day is the time we do our first application. Labor Day is a second one. And around Halloween, before Thanksgiving, and the ground freezes if you're going to do the holiday schedule. But even one fertilization in the fall, like that Labor Day fertilization, will really help your lawn and help reduce the weeds. And then the other option is, we all are trying to reduce our use or eliminate our use of chemicals. And the reason they became popular is that is the easier option. So proper lawn care, get your lawn healthy to crowd out the weeds. There's no magic bullet. It's just, if you are going to treat with an herbicide, read and follow label directions, and then spot treat versus the whole lawn. Weed and feeds are not real effective because you're not fertilizing and applying weed killer at the right time for either activity. So, and that's, again, where you could try that iron base, that chelated iron herbicide, if you want to go organic. It is a lot pricier, but it has been shown to be fairly effective. So that would be an option if you're looking for something a little more eco-friendly.
Yeah, and there's been some research on that Halloween fertilization, and I think they're not recommending it as much as they used to because a lot of the the nutrients are lost through winter. So that would be one less.
And again, depending on what you're using, thank you for bringing that up, Larry, and I should have mentioned that. One of the things, the research on Milorganite showed that the nutrients were stayed in the soils, but thank you for bringing that up. So I missed that new research, so appreciate that.
and the lawn height, 3 to 4 inches, cutting it high, that is one of the best things you can do.
And yep. A sharp mower blade. This is one of the things. Anytime I talk, I don't know about you, Larry, but anytime I mention that, I get the look like I'm supposed to sharpen my mower blade. The wounds close quickly. Your lawn looks better. You'll use less fuel, up to 22% less fuel It'll cut faster, and your lawn loses less moisture, so you can save water, too. I think it's up to 30%. Your lawn will use up to 30% less water just by having sharp blades. So we have a lot of rocks out where I live, and so we just have several sets of mower blades and have to change them regularly throughout the summer.
Yeah. I bought a new lawnmower this year, a new battery. Lawnmower, and that one it folds up like a suitcase, and so that when you're done, you can just fold it up like a suitcase, and actually there's a handle and you can drag it around like you're dragging around a suitcase at the airport. But the blades are then right up there and exposed and easy to get at, and so I guess I just put in an ad for battery operated lawnmower.
I have a battery-operated mower, great in the city because I hardly had any grass, but now I use it in my vegetable garden to mow my paths. And boy, you know what? That is great because they have a lot of power, and mine doesn't fold up like a suitcase, though, but I'm amazed at how well it cuts through, and, you know, it's an area that I can use to mow and keep the weeds down and mowing high. It's just great. So thank you. You know, that's a great option for a lot of us.
I love that new mower. I can tell you that for sure. Melinda Myers, our guest today, nationally known gardening expert, TV, radio host. Go to her website at melindamyers.com. Our guest on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for spending some of your day with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Melinda Myers, our guest today, nationally known gardening expert, TV, radio host, author, columnist. She does it all. And you might have a question for her. What gardening questions are on your mind? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you. And let's go to Marilyn in South Range. Marilyn, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. We live in a hayfield, in the middle of the hayfield, and we don't really fertilize our lawn, it just whatever is there. So we have a lot of dandelions and everything. But we also, I think it's quackgrass that invades our raised beds and the other gardens that I have. I need some help in how do you get rid of the quackgrass.
And I'm going to, and you probably know the difference, Marilyn, but quackgrass is a perennial, so it survives our winter. When you dig it up, it has these long white, they look like roots, but they're rhizomes, and any little piece of that left behind can start a new plant. And I have the same issue in my raised beds, too, and actually grows out the side and up the raised beds. What a mess. And so digging is the non-chemical option, and you have to be persistent, and you have to keep after it, and you have to make sure you get all the rhizomes. And I have been able to manage it in a couple gardens where I've been able to be very persistent. The other option you might want to do is a total, and I know I feel like I'm recommending using a lot of herbicides today, but one of the things is, again, being selective, but using something like a Roundup where you're putting it on the leaves of the plant so it's absorbed and it kills the roots in the rhizome. Check with timing because, you know, if you're growing food crops or other plants in that garden, you need to be very careful. You know, if it touches the good plants, it can damage or kill them as well. But with quackgrass, it's just a it's a perennial, very vicious. A friend of mine, Ray Greit, who taught me so much about gardening years ago, said the only solution is to burn it and spread the ashes on cement. Now, that was a joke, but when I've said that into groups, they look at me like, really? No, but it's that vicious. I mean, that's kind of how he felt the struggle was. So digging, disposing it, throw it in a clear plastic bag and cook it before if you're going to compost it. Some municipalities will let you throw small quantities of weeds, sick, disease stuff in the garbage. Check with your municipality, but if you compost it, it'll probably survive, and you don't want to put it back on the garden. So, again, dig, or spot treat with a total vegetation killer, and read and follow label directions carefully.
There you go, Marilyn. Thank you so much. You can join in, too. Get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234. Linda in Cudahy wonders if you use worm casings, if you like them.
Yeah, worm castings are excellent. In fact, I just cleaned out my worm bins from over the winter in one of my raised beds that really needed to be kind of revitalized. So what's kind of cool is you could make your own, and, you know, you just need a storage bin, drill some holes in the bottom because you'll get a little bit of leachage, have something underneath it, some aeration holes near the top. On my website, we have something from last year's library program, a video and kind of a step-by-step sheet on doing worm composting. And more places are selling them as well, so it's a great organic matter. I find the worm castings, I usually don't have as much as I do when I make a big compost pile, so I'm a little more selective. Maybe use them in my containers, maybe in my raised beds, depending on how many I have. They're great for part of your lasagna gardening. So excellent resource, and there are quite a few kind of worm farms in our area in southeast Wisconsin. So I think we're going to see more and more worm castings available and at much more reasonable prices than in the past.
We had a message from Don and related to the curly asparagus that we were talking about earlier.
Okay.
He wondered an alternative possibility might be that the plants need more nitrogen. Would that be the case?
You know, asparagus is deeply rooted, not a heavy feeder. It never hurts to have a soil test to find out. I haven't really seen nitrogen deficiencies causing that, but, you know, it doesn't mean that couldn't be a possibility. But I would, especially if you've already fertilized, usually with asparagus like rhubarb because they're perennial, usually low nitrogen, slower release fertilizers are recommended. They don't need real heavy feeding. But if you think that could be the problem, especially if I forget who I share my asparagus beetle issues with, if you don't see the beetles in the hot afternoon, you might want to get your soil tested. I would do that before adding any more fertilizer to the soil. But thank you for sharing.
Yep, a very good point. And another question about edible flowers.
Oh,
what are the ones that you like the best?
You know, University of Colorado has a great publication with a very extensive list. My favorites are nasturtium because you can eat the leaves and the flowers. Make sure they haven't been treated with a pest, you know, any kind of chemical. Take the reproductive parts out because that gives it that bitter flavor. And so it dresses up a salad. I love daylily buds. The buds taste like snap beans. And you can eat the flowers, you know, make frittatas, just, you know, lightly fry them, a little bit of, you know, flour and maybe some egg and fry them in butter. They taste good. Or stuff them with cream cheese. I mean, anything with cream cheese, right, tastes good. And squash blossoms. Back in the 80s, I haven't seen it. There was a squash that was promoted for the flowers, for their edible flowers. I forget the name of that squash. I haven't seen it lately. And so if you do serve up edible flowers as part of your meal, make sure to tell your guests they're edible. Otherwise, you'll have a big pile at the side of the plate, and they'll miss that wonderful flavor. Salvias, fuchsias, roses, if you haven't sprayed them with any chemicals, just wonderful. You know, it's just kind of a pretty way to elevate your food. Calendulas, right now, this cool weather, calendulas are pot marigolds. Those yellow blossoms or orange blossoms, mix them in with your salad greens. Just wonderful flavor and just adds that little gourmet elegant touch to any meal.
And I'm wondering, too, about edible ornamentals. I think you covered edible ornamentals in your webinar.
Yeah, so things like serviceberry. Anybody growing serviceberry knows that they taste, I think they have a nutty blueberry flavor. You have to be able to beat the birds, though, because the cedar waxwings and the robins love them. But they make great pies. They make great muffins, or just I will grab a handful as I weed. They're tasty that way. You could also do cornelian cherry dogwoods. They have red fruit, bright yellow flowers before the forsythia bloom. Red fruit that look like an elongated cherry. They're very astringent, so you have to pick them at the right time. But they make great jams and jellies and wine. A friend of mine makes lots of cornelian cherry wine, very tasty. Chokeberry, I'll tell you, I don't know if you've eaten chokeberry, but the name is very appropriate. It kind of sucks the spit out of your mouth. And I've traveled to exotic places like northern Minnesota and Dakotas, and they grow a lot of chokeberries there. And every time I speak, they're selling chokeberry or aronia, same plant, different, you know, common name chokeberry aronia. And they sell jams and jelly and wine. And I'll tell you, the wine is always gone by the time I finish working, so it's very popular. But I talked to a grower who said, you got to pick it when the sugar content is just right. So I do grow aronias. I never get out there usually at the best time. Also, elderberries, they're grown for their fruit, but they're also an ornamental. The black lace elderberry is one that is edible fruit. The elderberry that we grow for the fruit can be very aggressive. I moved mine out of the garden because it kept suckering and taking over, but the flowers are edible on elderberry. And the fruit, again, the birds love them, so whatever you don't pick, the birds will enjoy. And so those are good as well.
I'm with you. I know in your webinar you mentioned Brussels sprouts.
Yes.
And not everybody likes Brussels sprouts, but I love Brussels sprouts.
Me too.
Do you ever grill them?
I do. They're a long season crop, so you always want to start, you know, either plant the seeds directly in the garden in spring or buy transplants. And, you know, it's a fun one. I'm with you. I don't have to find anybody for Brussels sprouts. But I like to grow the purple ones because they're a little prettier, so that's your ornamental benefit. They're late season, so they're pretty in the garden all summer long with their reddish tinge or the blue-green leaves. Harvest them from the bottom up. A lot of people don't realize that's where Brussels sprouts come from. And when they're about an inch in diameter, one year I had a ton, I overplanted, so I gave them away to friends. And I took the whole stalk because I said, here, you can harvest them. And one of them said, you know, you add bacon, it tastes pretty good. Okay, whatever works, that's good. The other thing I've always struggled with is cauliflower. I don't know if you have good luck, but,
no.
You know, and I grew purple cauliflower last year, and I had success. And I had somebody call in and say they also found it much easier to grow because cauliflower, if you put it out too early and it gets nipped by frost, it can do what's called buttoning, and it'll form a small head that never fully develops. If you get it out, it starts to grow, and if it matures when the weather's hot, it gets all brown and curdy, and it tastes awful. And I've tried like three or four times. Well, last year I thought, well, I'm going to try this purple cauliflower, and it was great. I had a nice harvest. I only grew a couple plants, very pretty, and I was successful.
Good for you.
I know, because usually that's not the case with cauliflower.
Perry in Oconto has something. Let's go there. Hi, Perry.
Hello. Melinda, can you
tell
me what I should be looking for in a indoor potting mix for most plants? I'm not talking about the cactus or the succulents, but I guess you could throw it aside if an aloe plant would need something different. But what should I be looking for, or what kind of brands out there. What do I need?
You know, that's a great question, Perry. And I find, you know, finding the potting mix that works for you is always a challenge, indoors or outdoors. I mentioned Sue, HSU. They are ginseng growers in Wausau, Wisconsin area. And, you know, they were making compost for their ginseng farms. And then people were, you know, would bring their five-gallon bucket and say, ooh, can we have some of this good stuff? And so then they started making, bagging their leaf compost, but then they also started making potting mix. And for me, this works very well. As I mentioned before, it's got leaf compost, just a little bit of peat, rice hulls for drainage. I use it indoors and out because I find if I ever have to change my potting mix, I can throw it in the compost pile or in my garden beds. The people at Ebert's, excellent, excellent, very knowledgeable staff that I get a chance to work with at Ebert's, they like the Pro Mix, and it has coir, C-O-I-R, and I think some peat moss. It has perlite, that white substance for drainage. They swear by it. It didn't work well for me, and that doesn't mean it's not good. It means it wasn't a good match for me. And so I think part of the challenge is finding what works for you the way you garden. I tend to be an underwaterer. They found the Pro Mix gave them weeks, you know, not weeks, but many days on their outdoor gardens, but they also use it on indoor plants. And you're right, with cacti and succulents, you want a lot more coarse drainage material, those things that have more drainage material so it dries out, the same with the aloe. So I would say just trying some things, you know, that work for you. And for me, the Sioux has worked well. For the folks at Ebert's, their staff there, they love the Pro Mix. It's worked well for them and many of their customers as well. So I would say you might want to start with those. And I'm sure we probably could have 20 people call in Larry with 20 different recommendations on what works for them. So, Perry, good luck.
Good
luck. And
if
you find something else that you really go, this is great, let us know.
Thanks, Perry. Appreciate it. Del in East Dubuque, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Del.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Melinda, I had a question about peach trees. I've got about six peach trees in my yard. They're either dwarf or semi-dwarf. Last year, they produced a bumper crop, probably about 125 to 150 peaches. And so I kept, I pruned them late winter and headed them back and aggressively pruned them about probably about 40%, like the growers say you're supposed to do. And kept waiting for blossoms, but not a single blossom this year. Any speculation as to why? I mean, they're all Zone 4 peaches, mostly contenders, self-pollinating.
Right.
And they're delicious. But
oh, I know. And, I hear, and it's so frustrating, isn't it? Peaches are so, right from the tree, so tasty. When we got that cold snap here in where I live, it was about the time my peach trees were getting ready to bloom. I had a very poor flower set this year as well, and I'm worried that some of the flower buds may have begun swelling at the time when we were still getting some kind of, we'd have warm, cold, wondering if some of them were damaged that way. Because I didn't have a very good flower set this year. And so I think part of it for me, tracking the weather. Heavy pruning, one of the challenges too with heavy pruning, and I know with fruit trees they're typically pruned very heavily, sometimes that can switch the plant into more vegetative growth. So that could be an issue. But I'm going to blame the weather because I think it might have just been timing with this crazy winter we had with warm. And then, you know, one day we had 70 degrees, and then it was 13 the next morning, and things were budding early. So I'd kind of take a look at and see, you know, maybe some of the buds were just breaking, and that's when they're most sensitive to cold temperatures. Otherwise, avoid high nitrogen fertilizers. You probably wouldn't need to do as much pruning for next year. I'm just worried that
I'd lay back on
that. I'm worried maybe, even though that's what a lot of the professionals do, sometimes less is more, especially for home gardens. I know Illinois has great information on from their extension service as well, and UW has a great publication, University of Wisconsin, on pruning Cherries, Peaches, and Plums, I think is the name of the publication.
Yep. There you go, Dell. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And Roger in Grantsburg, your turn. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Great show. I've been on a farm, so it's like taking care of a lawn is kind of a, oh, my God, it's more of a chore than any kind of joy. And the lawn basically is, it's like, well, what kind of grass is it? Green? I don't know. It's green. It's grass. It grows too fast, and I can't keep up with it. If you don't mow every 3 days here, it's about 3 days, 4 days, when it, and now you're done, and you can't catch up. I mean, you might as well get the tractor and haybine and cut it and bale it, because you're not going to catch up, you know. But I found a thing that worked really good. I changed tractor tires, and I found a thing that works really good for weed control. The fluid out of the tires is basically salt water, calcium chloride. You squirt it around basal-like objects, something that's not going to – you don't want to do it around a tree, but other objects that's not going to bother. You squirt the skull of salt water around it, kills the weeds. They curl right up, and they're gone.
Yeah. Wow.
You just put it – that's – thank you for sharing that, Roger, and your comment about the grass growing is so true. You may have to mow over those clippings because they are so long. Just being careful, the old adage was with – asparagus, they used to recommend using salt to kill the weeds because asparagus was deeply rooted, but it did impact the production. So you just want to be careful because, you know, if you have de-icing salt from your walk that gets into your garden or your lawn, you know, it can damage it. So it's just, it's always like anything, whether it's commercial or a home remedy or something like you discovered, Rogers, just kind of monitor to make sure you're not getting any ill effects on the plants you're trying to keep. So thank you for sharing that.
Thanks, Roger. Appreciate it. Carrie in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I just have a question for Melinda. She's been posting on her Facebook page some a brand of flowers called Suntory,
and I haven't been able
to find them.
You know, Suntory has the Soiree vincas, and it's an annual vinca. One of my favorite is Flamenco. We called them to find out. I think what we're going to have to do, and Carrie, I'm really sorry because I know how frustrating it is. I looked for them last year. I had some samples sent to me. I'm going to have some to share at State Fair this year because they're sent. I said, you got to send me some samples. So the key is going to be for us to keep asking our local garden centers. I'm going to make a few calls, too. I've encouraged Suntory. I've said it's been a little hard for people to find them. So asking your garden center, they may still be able to find a grower that has them. If enough of us say we want to buy these, then the garden centers or the growers are more likely to grow them. But it's like any new introduction. And I hear your pain, Carrie. I feel bad recommending something I know that's very hard to find. You might check farmers markets. Think about who in your area tends to carry some of the unusual plants. But please help me by asking every garden center you visit about those so that we start making them a little more available. So hopefully next year they'll be a little easier to find. And I appreciate your frustration. And sorry I added to it, Carrie.
Thank you so much for calling, Carrie. And Melinda, thank you so much for being with us today. It's so much fun, and I'm looking forward to the next time we have a chance to talk. Thank you, Melinda.
Me too. You have a great day, and hello to all your listeners. Thanks for the opportunity.
Melinda Myers, go online to melindamyers.com. You'll take a look at that. You'll find the webinars and a lot of great information that's on her site. I really, really like it. And thanks so much for listening. On Monday, we will have a couple of shows for you. And remember, it's going to be a two-hour show. 2 hours. And don't forget to go to WPR.org/new to find out where you can hear us this particular show. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Have a great weekend. I'm Larry Mueller.